This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest finished number two, just below Sonny Rollins, in the 2008 Village Voice Jazz Critics poll. And in The New Yorker, jazz critic Gary Giddens called his last two albums astonishing. His name is Rudresh Mahanthappa. His parents are from South India and in the 60s moved to Boulder, Colorado, which is where Rudresh grew up. In spite of his Indian heritage, he didn't pay much attention to Indian music. He studied composition and alto saxophone at Berklee College of Music. But as you'll hear, a novelty gift from his brother led Rudresh to immerse himself in Indian music and collaborate with a master Indian saxophonist. We'll hear one of their collaborations later. Rudresh calls the band on his new CD the Indo-Pak Coalition. It features guitarist Reza Bassi, who was born in Pakistan. Dan Weiss is the tabla player. Here's the title track, Apti. Rudresh Mahanthappa, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us about one of the things happening in that piece that you think you wouldn't have known about if you hadn't studied Indian music.
My approach for a long time with Indian music, you know, when I first started listening, was more melodically oriented. And I was always fascinated with this idea of ragas, which are, in the West, they're often simplistically called modes, but they're much more complicated than that. They're much more complicated than the Western perception of scales because they often have an ascending form that's different from the descending form, and the notes sometimes will come out of order. They won't go straight up. It might go up a little bit and down and then up a little bit again. So with that title track there, with Apti, I was kind of trying to synthetically create something that was raga-like, even though the melodic material for that tune is not a traditional or even existent raga in Indian music.
You know, listening to your music, I think of it as being, some of it as being not so much melody as patterns. That there's like these patterns that you hear that are different than, say, song melody.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess I could hear that too. You know, I have this very kind of mathy sort of background.
Did you say mathy?
I studied mathy, yes,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And I think this the idea of permutation is something that I've always gravitated towards. Like, you know, here you have five notes. How many different ways can you order those five notes, both in sequence or rhythmically or however? And, you know, create these kind of cells that sound like I don't know, almost like a pinball bouncing back and forth between bumpers, but ricocheting a different way every time.
And is that compatible with Indian music?
Oh, I don't know if it's compatible with anything, but I think, you know, I see music and math and computation, and I mean, I see them all as being as coming from a similar part of the brain and a similar part of human existence. So the interesting thing with Indian music is there is definitely a strong emphasis on numbers, on math itself, more with regard to rhythm than the actual melodic stuff, though.
Were you supposed to become a math teacher instead of something more impractical like jazz musician?
It's funny, Terry, because I feel like everything that I gravitate towards within Anything I do, whether it be professional or as a hobby, is always in the most esoteric, impractical, inapplicable form. So even my fascination with math was, you know, in high school and junior high was more with number theory and abstract topology and things that have very little use. It's math that's beautiful. But has very little application. Like, it's very elegant. Like, you know, like Fermat's Last Theorem. I mean, it has no application, really. Well, I don't want to overstep my boundaries, but as far as I understand, it has no application, really. But it's beautiful.
Now, even though you're Indian American, are you surprised by how influenced you've ended up being by Indian music?
I think when I look back, I'm surprised. But Indian music was something that I felt like I had to discover on my own terms. You know, as a jazz musician, there's often this assumption that that you know about Indian music because you're Indian or because you have brown skin or something like that. So I felt like I had to discover that music myself instead of pretending like I was an expert on it. And I feel like I came into the music at the same time I was coming into understanding that that I do have a hybrid background, that that I don't feel entirely Indian, that I don't feel entirely American. And I think that's something that hits a lot of children of immigrants, you know, probably when they go off to college, like, you know, when you're 18, 19 years old. Sometimes it's a gradual thing. Sometimes it hits you like a hammer. I think for me it hit like a hammer.
I want to play another track from your latest CD, Opti. And you were talking about patterns and like mathematical patterns that you see in music and shifting these cells around. And I think what you're talking about is evident in the piece that I want to play. And you're going to have to tell me what the title is, because I'm not sure whether it's IIT or LLT or two ones and a T. I'm not sure. Not sure how to read this title. So be my guest.
That's funny. It's IIT, which actually refers to the Indian Institute of Technology.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which is that's the school that everybody dies to get into out of high school. By getting into IIT, you kind of guarantee yourself a job in the, you know, in the technical world or the engineering world. I would say that most of the Indian immigrants that you see in Silicon Valley probably went through IIT. It's a very grueling process, but it's supposed to be worth it if you can get in and make it out alive.
So why did you write a song with the title?
Because this song is actually quite quite math oriented, but in a very traditional South Indian way. Now, you have to understand, in Indian music, one doesn't talk about measures like we do in Western music. We don't talk about 4-4 or 3-4. We don't talk about these traditional song forms, say, of like that jazz standards are based on, where it's 32 bars and divided into 4 8-bar sections. In Indian music, one speaks more about beat cycles and number of beats. So you might have something that's a 4-beat cycle or an 8-beat cycle, a 7-beat cycle. One that you see often is a 21-beat cycle. It's three groups of seven. So IIT was based on this traditional way of breaking down 32 beats. And 32 beats, you know, we can think of that in the West as, you know, 8 bars of 4-4. So there are two things happening at once there. You can hear the overall pulse of the 8 bars of 4-4. But on top of that, you have this, again, it's kind of a traditional rhythmic superimposition of grouping, where we're going to go 6-5-4-3-2-3-4-5. And if I did my math right, that should add up to 32. So the kind of auditory illusion is something that's there's the big grouping of the six, and the groupings are shrinking and expanding again.
Is there any way you can kind of clap at the type of rhythmic divisions that you're talking about?
Yeah, I can try. Let me see here. So you hear the melody goes like, so you have this thing that starts. The first segment is da da dee da, da is yeah da da dee da 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 da. So I don't know if you can follow that, but you hear this kind of punch where the clap is, where the punch in the tabla is, gets shorter and shorter every time, and then it expands again. So it's this thing that kind of collapses in on itself and expands. It's a really cool sound, I think.
So why don't we hear IIT from your CD Opti and hear how all this sounds with your ensemble. So this is Rudresh Mahanthapa on alto, Reza Bassi on guitar, and Dan Weiss on tabla. You traveled to India a few years ago and worked with a saxophonist there, an Indian saxophonist, whose work you had heard recorded. And before we talk about your interactions with him, Kadri Gopalnath, tell us how you first heard his music. It's a great story.
Well, when I was at Berklee College of Music, I had heard that there was a Carnatic saxophonist, a South Indian saxophonist, but I didn't really think anything of it. And as kind of a congratulatory present after I'd done like a big like senior recital or some big concert of my own music, my older brother jokingly gave me the CD called Saxophone Indian Style. And to him, he thought it was hilarious. But I saw it and I said, oh, my God, this is that guy I've been hearing about. It was very funny to me that it was funny that he thought it was just a prank. And one of the things also with these Indian classical music albums, which is somewhat unfortunate, is they all have, let's just say that not a lot of thought has gone into some of the titles. So Saxophone Indian Style is a pretty funny thing, you know. But the album blew me away, you know. I couldn't believe that somebody was playing Indian music authentically on the saxophone. I couldn't believe somebody even had access to a saxophone in India. I mean, that to me seemed already kind of bizarre.
Because it's such a Western instrument?
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, here, you know, in New York, I can tell you 50 places where you could go and buy a saxophone. I couldn't tell you where to go buy a saxophone in Bombay, you know. But the other main musical issue is that in Indian music, you have this very complicated system, or complex system, I should say, of ornamentation that, again, in the West, it's kind of glossed over by being referred to as microtonal or quarter tones, and it's much more complex than that. But it involves being able to kind of slide between notes, and this ornamentation is kind of like you won't play a note directly on it. You might play just a little bit above it and a little bit below it, and it's like this very decorative ornamentation of just an individual note, and there might be 100 ways to ornament one note, which is why I think Indian music is so dynamic, even though on the surface it seems like you're not dealing with very much melodic material because you're just dealing with these ragas or something like that. So obviously this kind of ornamentation, which we call gamaka, is much more conducive to singing or playing violin or, you know, playing an instrument where you can actually slide. And the way the saxophone is constructed, it's what we call, you know, a fixed whole instrument. You know, there is arguably, I mean, some people would argue with me, but traditionally the way the saxophone is played, there is no real way to slide between notes in a way that's clean. So what was amazing about Kadri initially is that he really figured out how to do that on the saxophone. And it wasn't a gimmick that he was just playing South Indian music on the saxophone. It was that he's playing Carnatic music at a very high level, and it just so happens he's playing the saxophone.
Okay, so I want to play Kadri Gopalnath, and then you can tell me what you heard, like what revelations you heard when you heard this. So here it goes. Okay, so that's Kadri Gopalnath, who introduced my guest Rudresh Mahanthapa to this Indian style of saxophone playing. And Rudresh, what did you hear in that? And let me just say, I find especially interesting those long-held notes with the kind of stops in between.
Well, what we heard there, I have to tell you, I'm kind of I've transcended elsewhere. I haven't heard that album in years because it was actually stolen out of my car about 10 years ago.
No.
So just to hear that little bit there, I'm just kind of my feet are about 8 inches floating off the ground. So thank you for playing that for me. What we heard there, structurally, that's called the alap, which is an opening. It's an opening solo that's out of time. You know, there was no pulse there. We didn't hear any drums there. Mm-hmm. And it's usually something that happens at the beginning of a concert, but not necessarily. It can happen anywhere in a concert. But it does usually happen at the beginning and then maybe another time. And it's a way of introducing the raga. It's a way of introducing the melodic content of what's going to come once like an actual song or composition is going to come in later. And it's kind of a way of introducing each note of the raga to the audience. So it's a really interesting idea, I think, conceptually, something that we don't hear in the West. It's almost like I'm going to make musical friends with the audience, you know, before this concert continues. You know, it's a really nice idea, and it's something that I'd like to do as a jazz musician as well in my own concerts and my own albums.
And now I want to kind of fast forward to the pulse part, the raga part of the.
Well, this
of that
is where the
piece.
Song comes in. I mean, we're still it's all raga based. This is where mm-hmm. where the percussion comes in. Mm-hmm. That's where we talk about tala, and tala is those are those beat cycles I was talking about. Mm-hmm. If I remember right, the first thing that we hear on this album is a 16-beat beat cycle. I could be wrong. It's been a long time.
Okay, well, let's fast forward to the beat cycle part. Here it is.
Okay.
Rudresh, did that part knock you out too?
Yeah, it definitely knocked me out. I'm sorry to just be, you know, laughing like crazy over here, but it's, oh man, every time I hear that album and every time I hear him, I get so elated and excited. It's just, it brings back lots of good memories and it's very inspiring at the same time.
You had said that there's a great story behind how Kadri Gopinath started playing saxophone, which is an unusual instrument for classical Indian music.
Yeah, well, you know, his father was a Nathaswaram player. Nathaswaram is a double reed instrument, a South Indian double reed instrument that sounds a lot like an oboe. So he definitely grew up with music, but it's not like his father was famous or something. His father played at the local temple, which is often where you hear Nathaswaram. But I guess he saw one of the British palace bands when he was really young, and there was a saxophonist in the band, and he was completely blown away by the sound and by the way it looked, and just everything about it really knocked him out. And obviously there was no template, you know, there was no predecessor, to playing of there being a saxophonist in Indian music, period. So he really had to carve out his own... I want to say his own niche, but it obviously has become bigger than a niche. But he had to find his own way for sure. And, you know, one of the things that I think is very touching and endearing about his story is that his life was a lot like that of a jazz musician, or was a lot like that of a jazz musician, where, well, in Indian music, one of the things you see is this idea of lineage being very important. And I don't mean lineage necessarily only meaning, you know, someone is the son or daughter of so-and-so who was a great musician. Lineage can also manifest as far as who you studied with and who they studied with and who they studied with. And you can actually go on the internet and see these family trees that aren't really family, but it's a tree of tracing who you studied with back to some, you know, a great master musician that might go back 300 or 400 or 500 years. Obviously, Kadri didn't have that advantage as a saxophonist. So fortunately, he was able to find a few instructors that really supported what he did. But it took a long time for the Indian music community to actually take him seriously. And when I liken his life to that of a jazz musician, it's like he didn't have this privilege of lineage. He worked in an electronics store and sold transistor radios and from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening, and he came home and would practice about 6 hours and then sleep 4 hours and go do that all over again. So he, you know, and that kind of reminds me of, you know, what my life was like when I first moved to New York or something like that, you know, just really finding your own way and creating your own voice and really sticking to your guns.
Well, you not only toured with Kadri Gopinath, you recorded with him on your album Kinsmen. And
right.
I want to play a track from that. The track I want to play is called Ganesha. And I'd like you to talk about what you're doing here musically. And since both you and Kadri Gopinath are on alto saxophone, who's doing what?
Let's see. Okay, so Ganesha is actually, you know, again, I'm trying to kind of create this simultaneity of Eastern and Western, of Indian and jazz happening at the same time. So Ganesha is actually a blues in that regular kind of blues form, except that it happens to be, instead of we often talk about the 12-bar blues in Western music. This is a 6-bar blues because it's at a slower tempo, but it's also based on the 7-beat pattern that I referred to earlier. And one can actually think about it as 3 groups of 21 beats, which is something I also, you know, talked about earlier, this idea of a 21-beat cycle. So I'm playing something that's more akin to kind of a blues riff, and Kadri is playing something that's more raga-based. But the raga that we're working with, actually, when I first heard it, sounded so incredibly bluesy to me. I couldn't help but think that, okay, I really need to write a blues.
Okay, well, let's hear Ganesha from Rudresh Mahanthapa's album Kinsmen.
Hey.
That's Ganesha from the album Kinsmen, an album by my guest, the alto saxophonist and composer Rudresh Mahanthappa. I want to read something from the liner notes to your latest album, Opti. In those liner notes, you write, and this is about the fact that you're playing Indian-inspired music now. You write, I first started a version of this group when I lived in Chicago back in 1996. There was a sort of pressure put upon me to do something Indian, as if there was no precedent for an Indian-American jazz musician at that time. I disbanded the group rather quickly, as I felt that I lacked the skills and knowledge to lead such a trio with musical and cultural integrity. In wanting to avoid any notions of exoticism or exploitation of my ancestry, I went back to my comfort zone of leading bands of more traditional jazz instruments. So let's look at that statement.
That's pretty heavy, right?
Yeah, what kind of pressure was put on you to do something Indian since you were Indian American?
Well, maybe, you know, the pressure could be self-inflicted to some degree. You know, there was no template for an Indian American jazz musician at that time. So it seemed like the way to get over was to do something that was, you know, do something that was really blatantly Indian, something that was, you know, with a sitar player, you know. I mean, this is coming from a whole background of hearing things like, oh, you know, your music sounds really great. I can really hear the Indian influence. And, you know, to me, up till that point, the Indian music influence in my music was, I don't want to say it was subtle, it was definitely in there, but it was also very personal. So when somebody said, I really hear the Indian influence, I always wondered what they meant. And I'm sure their sentiments were very positive, but I couldn't help but feel that they were saying that because of my name and because of the color of my skin, because even then, I felt like my music was coming more out of Charlie Parker or John Coltrane than it was, you know, Ravi Shankar or Kadri Gopalnath, for that matter.
So how did you start hearing jazz? I mean, you're, what, 37 now?
Right.
So I think most people your age did not grow up with jazz. Jazz is no longer a popular music. It's more of an art music, an esoteric music. A lot of people think of it as music for older people.
Yes, so, they do.
Yeah. So how did you start listening? How did it become important to you?
Well, it was more via the instrument. I chose to play saxophone when I was in fourth grade, I guess. That was the year that you could choose a band instrument. That's a year that you could be in the school band. And my older brother had played clarinet, and he always regretted the not being able to be in the jazz band, because he said that everyone in the jazz band looked like they were having more fun. And I had no idea what jazz was, but I heard the word fun, and as a fourth grader, and said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And what are you going to do? I mean, if you're a saxophonist, I mean, you know, playing jazz or listening to jazz is kind of the logical thing. I mean, had I played guitar, I would have been a rock musician. And I had a really good teacher growing up too. I had the same teacher from when I started all the way till I left for college. And I mean, he played in jazz groups, he played in progressive rock groups, he played in all sorts of little avant-garde configurations. And so I was turned on to a lot of music by going to hear him play, and also him loaning me albums and all that. So, so I heard what I was first into was more like the instrumental soul and R&B, like Grover Washington Jr., David Sanborn, stuff that's unfortunately considered to be smooth jazz now. But I think back then it had a more of a bite to it. It really was instrumental soul or R&B. And then I heard Charlie Parker when I was in sixth grade or seventh grade, and that was the end. I was hooked.
I want to play another track of yours from your album Kinsmen, and this is a piece called Longing. And I want to play this because it's different from what we've been hearing. We've been hearing these like clearly Indian-inspired compositions of yours with that kind of mathematical pattern that you've been describing of melody and rhythm. But this starts off almost like it's more of a Coltrane ballad. and so I'd like you to talk about this piece before we hear it.
Yeah, Longing is an interesting one. It actually, the melody is very strictly based on a raga that Kadri and I worked on together. And, you know, in the same way that in the West you take a major scale or a minor scale and you build harmony and then you write a tune and all the harmony implies the scale, you know, you can do that with a raga, and usually that sounds really cheesy. But with this particular one, I just thought that there was going to be a way that I could really do something like that. So there are real chords. There are these kind of thick, lush chords that are all kind of mostly built from notes in the raga, but I kind of played around with that. And yeah, it really does sound like, you know, like a contemporary Western jazz ballad, but it goes to these other sections and that kind of brings it back to its Indian roots. I like how it turned out. For me, that was a big risk to write this tune and put it on the album.
Well, Rudresh Mahanthapa, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk to you, Terry. It's really wonderful.
That's Kadre Gopalnath with Rudresh Mahanthapa on Rudresh's CD, Kinsmen. Rudresh's new CD is called Upti. He spells his last name Mahanthapa, M-A-H-A-N-T-H-A-P-P-A. In the 1960s, electric guitarist Grant Green was one of the workhorses of the Blue Note Jazz label. He recorded dozens of albums under his own name, and even more as a sideman, for Stanley Turrentine, Sonny Clarke, Big John Patton, and many more. Green's first Blue Note album has now been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it demonstrates the durability of the blues.
The blues, that musical form usually 12 bars long with three basic chords moving underneath, ranks among the 20th century's great contributions to world culture. The blues is as indestructible as titanium and malleable as gold, whether coming from Memphis Minnie on a Beale Street corner, Count Basie at the Reno Club, or Cream at the Royal Albert Hall. Even one musician's blues can contain multitudes. On Grant Green's Grant's First Stand from 1961, five of the six tunes are blues, all played by a stripped-down trio. The challenge for Green is to expound at length on one topic without repeating himself. Sometimes he roots his lines in earthy, well-worn patterns. Other times, he gets a bit more abstract. Here's a little blues medley to make the point. Thank you. Grant Green didn't go in for distortion or other special effects. He liked a neutral amplifier tone to let you hear those metal strings ring. Jazz musicians' blues are usually slicker than a straight-ahead blues guitarist. Green has a solid swinger's knack for skippy airborne jazz rhythms, but some of his lines wouldn't sound out of place in a Chicago blues bar if he had a more gritty tone. Green's compadres are drummer Ben Dixon and organist Roosevelt Babyface Ouellette. Like the guitarist, Ouellette played gospel music coming up. It fed his approach, the way spirituals inform the blues in general. Blues is sort of the flip side of spirituals. Religious folk even denounced it as the devil's music. That duality of the sacred and profane is implicit in jazz organ groups, splitting the difference between the rituals of Saturday night and Sunday morning. Bluesy organ groups like Grant Green's were very popular by 1961, then fell way out of favor in some circles. Later, they became fashionably retro, seeding hip-hop with a billion samples and loops. The blues has had its ups and downs as a commercial property, too, but with times like they are now, could be making a comeback.
Kevin Whitehead is currently on leave from teaching at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the reissue Grant's First Stand by guitarist Grant Green on the Blue Note label. Elaine Showalter helped usher in the initial wave of feminist literary criticism in the 1970s with her book on British female writers called A Literature of Their Own. Showalter went on to have a distinguished career at Princeton. She served as president of the Modern Language Association, and she's written sometimes controversial, scholarly, and popular criticism. Now retired from teaching, Showalter has just brought out her much-anticipated opus, the first literary history of American women's writing, called A Jury of Her Peers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it makes her feel like a giddy young grad student again.
For those of us crepuscular enough to remember the first flowerings of feminist theory and women's literature courses in college, part of the pleasure of reading Elaine Showalter's grand new work of literary history, A Jury of Her Peers, derives from nostalgia. It was such a disco inferno thrill back in the late 70s and early 80s to glimpse, for the first time, a lost continent of books, a veritable Herland, at the time uncharted by those male-dominated Norton anthologies. Early feminist literary archaeologists excavated the work and life stories of forgotten women writers such as Phyllis Wheatley, Fanny Burney, and Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Granted, some of the disinterred turned out to have curiosity value only. Elizabeth Barrett Browning's 9-book novel in blank verse, Aurora Leigh, may have been a hit in 1857, but as someone who read it and taught it in those dizzying gynocentric days, I'm here to tell you that it's a little slow. In recent decades, academic recovery work has sharply tapered off. All the poshest tombs have been raided, and more importantly, it now seems a tad unsophisticated to simply want to wedge a forgotten woman writer into the canon when the idea of the canon itself has been problematized. But Elaine Showalter has never been a slave to academic fashion, though she's certainly gotten into hot water with other feminist critics for writing too enthusiastically about fashion. In her introduction to what she says is the first comprehensive literary history of women's writing in America, Showalter bulldozes through the usual objections to literary history being worthwhile, politically correct, or even doable. A jury of her peers attempts the mammoth task of discussing and unapologetically judging the writing produced for publication by American women from the days of Puritan Anne Bradstreet to the modern-day gay cowboy tales of Annie Prue. Of course, Showalter stumbles sometimes on this long matriarchal march. For instance, she doesn't seem as engaged in the final chapters of this book, maybe because contemporary writers like Prue and Toni Morrison are all too familiar to us. But in addition to the sheer jumbo size of this project, two things make it a critical standout. First, there's Showalter's commitment to gathering both high and low writers in one place, and thus giving us a different sense of literary history. Respectable founding mothers like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Willa Cather share space with Grace Metalius of Peyton Place fame and lesbian pulp princess Anne Bannon. And even more crucial to the value, and certainly to the incendiary potential of this book, is Showalter's bossy critical presence throughout its pages. As a feminist scholar, Showalter rejects the voice of God narrative style of traditional literary history. Instead, she opines with zest on the personalities and books of the writers here. Take this kick in the bloomers to Gertrude Stein. Showalter concludes her irreverently brief entry on Stein with a paragraph of dismissal. Here are its first and last sentences. Although she is widely acknowledged to be unreadable, incomprehensible, self-indulgent, and excruciatingly boring, in the 20th century, Stein has always had a cult of devotees. Stein seems more and more like the empress who had no clothes, a shocking sight to behold in every respect. I don't agree with Showalter about Stein, but I do relish her critical gusto and guts. A jury of her peers includes so many writers and dusts off so many intriguing books and poems that to even give a sense of its scope would reduce this review to a chorus line. Suffice it to say that Showalter has inspired me with the quaint resolve to read, among others, Mary Rowlandson, who wrote the first white woman's narrative about being taken captive by Indians, Pauline Hopkins, who in 1902 produced a feminist, African-American spin on popular quest romances like Treasure Island, and Julia Ward Howe, poet, novelist, author of The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and heroine of a life story that should have been made into one of those glorious Joan Crawford Hollywood weepies. The unorthodox intelligence with which Showalter discusses the work of these and a cavalcade of other American women writers makes a literary history like a jury of her peers, which some would regard as an old-fashioned project, its own critical excuse for being.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Jury of Her Peers by Elaine Showalter. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. I'm Terry Gross.